Welcome to Unique Connections at the Table. I'm Dr. Beverly Samways, and each episode we invite you to join the conversation and discover new ways of seeing the world, particularly in relation to those with learning disabilities. So pull up a chair, the table's set, and we're so glad you're here.
Good morning, Noelle. It's absolutely lovely to have you on Unique Connections YouTube channel. Absolute joy to have you with us. So I'll just introduce you. So this is Dr. Noelle Blackman, and she has decades of experience thinking about trauma-informed care and trauma and people with learning disabilities. So like really, in fact, when we started this channel, I was thinking, I hope Noelle comes on one day.
So lovely to be here, Ben. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're welcome. So just to give a bit of background to your experience, so you led Respond as their CEO for many years, and Respond is a provides psychotherapy for people with learning disabilities, particularly those who've experienced trauma. And you're currently working with the Restraint Reduction Network and Build, and leading their leadership diploma in trauma-informed practice. So yeah, vast amounts of experience and knowledge in this field. So and we're here today to talk about trauma and people with learning disabilities and thinking about that from both an individual and an organisational perspective, right?
Right. Where do we start?
I know. Where do we start?
Such a big subject, but it's so lovely to actually have time to stop and think and reflect and talk together. I think it's important.
Yeah, it is. It is. So, like, maybe if you can start by just reminding us what we actually mean when we say trauma, because it gets used all the time, that word. But what are we actually talking about?
Yeah, good point. Well, trauma is actually our internal response to overwhelming things that happen in our lives, things that overwhelm our ability to think and stop and consider how we might respond. So all the unconscious responses that you all know will happen if there's a fire or you're in a jungle and a lion comes. So, you know, there'll be all those fear responses, flight, fight, flop, I can never just run them off my hand, but they all begin with F pretty well. But all of those things that are unconscious responses, you'll either run away, you'll stop and fight, you might freeze the other one, flop, and a new one that has come about really through the work, particularly around domestic violence, is fawn, where we might just do anything to keep in favor with the threat. But it all happens unconsciously. And that's the key thing. And the remaining trauma, so when we're talking about trauma beyond that moment, so the post-traumatic effects of trauma, which may become quite disordered and stay with us forever until we do something about it. So PTSD or complex PTSD are the physiological effects that remain in our bodies and really never die down and are very quick to be re-stimulated when something reminds us or triggers that response.
Yeah, that's so helpful. I think, like, Perry talks about, like, the default operating system becomes the fight, flight, freeze, as opposed to the regulated operating system.
Yeah, absolutely. And regulation is the key word here. And that's the thing that's so important when we're working with somebody who is so traumatized. And also, I mean, the people that I've worked with, and I think actually for people with learning disabilities generally, it's rarely, PTSD tends to be one traumatic thing has happened. You've had a terrible car crash and you've survived and it's traumatic. Mm. But actually we're working with people where trauma has rippled throughout their lives in many different ways. And that's what we mean by complex PTSD. Much, much more difficult to use kind of brief interventions with. So for PTSD, there's a great intervention, EMDR, a rapid eye movement kind of hypnotizing thing, and because it's around a specific one specific thing, you can use that to shift the trauma across the brain. and work it through. When it's complex trauma, that's so much harder because it's just rippling around in your body at all times. It's interpersonal and it's triggered just all the time, really. Rarely not on high alert.
So you know that our work at Unique Connections is largely with people with little or no spoken communication, usually, is it? And so what, like, I feel like this is probably one part of the world where we don't hear loads about trauma. We hear a lot about behavior, we hear a lot about challenge, but we don't really hear much talk about trauma. So, like, what is there, like, to just talk to us me about that. Like, is it because is there less trauma if you have a severe learning disability? Is it less likely to manifest? Like, what's going on there? What How would it be for someone like that?
Experience more trauma. I think you're more likely to be disempowered, to have people doing things to you, at you, for you, without your engagement in choosing any of that. All of which are layers of traumatic experiences. It's very interesting because I think that people expect when you're going to work with somebody around their trauma, the key thing you're going to do is you're going to talk to them about the trauma and you want them to tell you about the trauma. And actually, that's the last thing that we do. I'm not that interested in people telling me about their trauma. In fact, it's extremely re-traumatizing on the whole to expect people to tell you about their trauma. But that's what people kind of want. They're hungry to know, what is it? What is this thing that's making you like this? And also, it's rarely one thing, so it's really difficult to people for people to say this is what it is. This is why I like this. And so I think that people who don't use spoken language to communicate are going to have that even more. No one's going to be able to say what's happened, so we can just overlook really that that's had any effect on that person, and just look at them as a part being, that has behaviors that we need to manage. Horrible. I have really bad even saying that, but that's what I see. That's what I've witnessed. I worked in a long stay hospital for many, many years, and there were wards with people who didn't use spoken language, who it really was a terrible dehumanizing. I was so shocked when I first went there at the dehumanizing of it. And it, of course, it becomes normal in those places, but it never became normal for me. I was just always so shocked. And my response, that's when I first came across, I'm sure you use it a lot, intensive interaction. And that to me was, it was just obvious that that was how I should work. And then I realized there's a natural kind of framework for this. And you'd see people change in front of your eyes and become the person they are that no one it really elicited from them before, because they just were fed and watered and behaviorally managed.
So what how would it present for somebody with, somebody who has a severe learning disability, then non-verbal? Like I think some people would want, and this is where it gets like not easy, they would want to know what's the difference between challenging behavior and a trauma presentation. And
They miss it. They're usually one and the same, to my mind. That would be what I would say. All behavior has its roots in something. But people are rarely just using their behavior to manipulate something, which is often what I hear. And behavior is often actually very unconscious. It's a bit of behavior. I even hate, what is behavior? We all, have ways of behaving in all the time. What is that word even mean? But what is described as challenging behavior, it's almost always an unconscious response to something. It's not a calculated, manipulative response, but that is often how it's seen. And our job, I feel, my job has been so often, is to kind of see this person in the context of their history and have some sense that this is coming from their history. And it's been exacerbated by what's happening in the now. Something has triggered in the now the things that have happened to this person in their life.
That's and that's like that That bit about story and the context of somebody's life, I feel like for years now, that consistently gets lost for people with no spoken communication. That because they can't tell you their story, something feels like it gets inside teams and organizations where they feel like maybe they don't have a right to know the story, or they don't have a right to talk about the person's story. And then maybe it doesn't matter. And maybe then we have an option to treat somebody simply in the context of their now, like that we only ever think about what's happening now. So I've definitely experienced teams scrabbling round for a now explanation of how somebody is presenting. So I remember a fascinating conversation a while back with a staff member, and a young person had had, an absolute meltdown over breakfast, and he was trying to look for the sort of now explanation, and the one that they'd come up with as a team was that they had run out of Marmite, and this young man had just was unable to tolerate that there was no Marmite left. And as we pulled this child's story and narrative wider than this morning and what had happened this morning, he began to think about the fact that the young man had experienced some family losses in his life. And I remember him saying to me, if this young person got upset because there's no Marmite, then that's easy for us to solve, but we can't relate to it because I've never lost it over Marmite. Like I can't relate to that. That means that this child is occupying such a different space to me. But if the child got upset because of the loss of a family member, I can't solve it, but I can relate to it. And it felt like a lovely articulation of the struggle to find a place for trauma, because if we can even just imagine that a child is getting upset because of a family loss, then we feel powerless because we can't fix it. We can fix the Marmite, we can't fix the death of a family member. But also, if we say it's the Marmite, the now moment, we can other the child because they're not like us. We don't do that.
Yes, there's such a lot in that actually, because if we can't fix the loss of the family member, we could fix the Marmite. That makes us feel powerful again. But we also feel a bit irritated by the amount of crazy chaos you've caused around Marmite. So then we feel even more powerful because we can have a judgment about that and put you back on your place. So there's an awful lot about empathy, but also power dynamic that plays out within a staff group that often are made to feel really powerless themselves, actually, as well. And that's an important thing to think about. I think the whole cultures of organizations and care workers often have very little power.
Yeah, that is really true. That's sort of like the power to clearly explain what's happening for another person, even like to get it in a behavior plan. How do you can get Marmite in a behavior plan? You can't get the loss of a family into a behavior plan.
Well, you can. It's much more complicated, and you have to think very carefully. And it might mean you have to bring other professionals in, and there's scarce resources, and so it goes on.
So it's a I find that there's not very much space to talk about trauma in this sector because there's not very much internal space for the complexity of it. But if we can find a space, actually lots and lots of new things open up, like the possibility that the person in front of us is very ordinary and their responses are very ordinary. And that we could potentially help them not through a plan, but through a relationship.
Well, that's the key. And now you're talking golden nuggets, because that is the key. The relationship is everything. And just before we really start to get into relationship, because I think that's such an important part of what we're talking about, I wanted to raise something that Valerie Sillerson often writes about, and that is the pain of pain, the hurt, I think, sometimes for people to be with people who are so disabled and who can't tell you very much about themselves. And I think that people cover up that pain by trying to find a way to be in the know. So we talked about power, but to know what they should be doing, to have a to be busy. You know, people are often really happy to be busy. You know, I've got my what we do now is we clear the tables and we get you dressed and we get you to the, you know, there's a thing to do. But actually to just sit with someone who's hurting, who can't tell you anything about that, who maybe has a presentation that's quite uncomfortable to watch because it might be, you know, I don't know, somebody may have cerebral palsy and their bodies may be twisted in some ways that maybe make people feel uncomfortable. And we're not good, I think, at allowing ourselves to meet the person within all of that that they're having to live with because it hurts.
Yeah, that is so true. And I think, you're right. I'm so many memories are like springing into my mind of like probably my most meaningful relationships with, some of the those that I've worked with over the years who can't speak. And when over time you start to unravel the different layers of what's underneath their the times when they get really, really upset or really distressed. I remember a young lady years ago, who I still keep in touch with, they're still friends, had so many difficulties, lots of physical disabilities, sensory loss, autism, and nonverbal. She used a wheelchair. She would hurt herself really, really severely, have these big episodes of like very severe self-injury. And after about 10 years of working with her, we had a really unusual conversation. She found about five words that she could say that day, which was really unusual for her. And we sat in the park and she was able to talk to me by indicating different parts of her body and talking about how she felt about herself and about her family. It was the most, I'll never forget it. It changed my life. And one of the things she was able to express was that she felt a lot of grief about the fact that her body didn't work in the way that she saw other people's bodies working, that that she couldn't walk, she needed a wheelchair. And also because she would hurt herself so much with her arms, so she would punch herself in her head, that there was all this extra care that would go into her arms, and so they became less and less useful. And I remember her hitting her arms, and almost like, what have my arms done to me? My arms, they don't work in the same, I can't do the same things as other people, but instead these arms have become the weapons that I've thrown against myself. And the deep grief she felt about her body and about the way it functioned and how difficult it was for her to live in it. She was often in pain. It was so hard for her to do ordinary things in a day. And I think I had not considered like how weighty and painful it was for her to live the life that she was living inside of the body that was not serving her well. And all this came out in our conversation, and it changed the way I understood her.
For her to tell you that, you know, that's a very important thing, and so it kind of leads us really nicely into relationship actually. That on the whole, I think staff unconsciously protect themselves from being available to that pain because it is too much. You kind of unconsciously know that pain is enormous, and actually working relationally means that you allow somebody to start to trust you and know that. And get a sense of unconsciously how much of that pain you can share with them. So that's what I imagine you indicated without perhaps even knowing.
I think on and I found this in my PhD as well. Although the pain, when you get into that place where you can see and experience somebody else's pain and struggle, it's really weighty, but there's gold there because, if like the real stuff of life is in the connection points, isn't it? Where we connect with each other, where we see who the other person really is, and they see who we are. And so whilst these these places of pain are very difficult to occupy. There's this golden thread all the way through of that's the connection point, that actually we really connect when we understand and sit with somebody in their worst moment. Not, the best moments are great and we should have them, but it's the work, we all know that. Like when, my worst places in my life, the people who could sit with me in those moments, they're my closest friends. And some of them became my closest friends because they could do that. And I think that's, when I look back on the relationships that I've formed over the years, it is those young people and adults where, regardless of whether they have a learning disability or not, where that's happened, that we there's that it's like an unbreakable connection.
Absolutely. I'm thinking back to the hospital that I told you about where I first really started my work. Big long stay hospital was starting to move people out into the community, and so we started to bring innovative things into the hospital as well. And we brought this incredible man called Wolfgang Stanger. Don't know if you've ever come across him.
No.
He's a dancer and choreographer, and he does mixed billet, like all of his work is accessible to all. And so he would come specifically to run dance days, workshop days, whole day, that was open for people with learning disabilities in the hospitals, perhaps, but also outside the hospitals to come in with somebody supporting them. So it would be for the duo, the person with the learning disability and their supporter, to learn to be together and dance, actually. So he always brought things like amazing big sheets, pieces of material or scarves or hoops or things that would connect them but give them distance. And then he would play the most incredible music. Often it was film scores and things that were really full of emotion and, took you on a journey. And then these magic things would happen between people. And it was a re that real golden connection that you talked about there with no words. Nearly all of these people actually didn't use words, but the communication was enormous. And the joy in the day, and sometimes the sadness as well, that just was allowed to be there, I suppose.
Amazing. Amazing. So I feel like we've gone off on a tangent of relationships that we're both totally passionate about and
Yeah, well, I don't think it is a tangent because I think that it is the most important thing. And I think that often the people that we see, because trauma has become such a difficult thing in their lives, when you start to look at what's happening, is actually that everybody's frightened of them a lot of the time. People are frightened, so there's less and less relating going on with them. Family may have they may have been removed from family in some way, or family may have become fragmented. And actually, that's the absolute opposite of what's needed. So, in order to begin to trust the world, so if we think about trauma, that people have kind of now conceptualized what's needed when someone's traumatized in a sort of framework that has kind of six components, and it might be quite helpful to think a little bit about those now. So, people really need safety first and foremost, a safe environment, and if they can speak. To know that it's okay to ask for what they need to feel safe. And if they can't speak, then we have to be extra vigilant and look and know what kind of environments make this person feel safe. Do we need to speak quietly? Do we need to have one or two people? Or, how do we work with this person, make them feel safety? And then through that, building trust. Now, trust is never a given. You have to work for trust. Trust comes from really gently trying to build a safe relationship with a person, one that has some boundaries around it, so the person knows what's okay and what isn't okay as well. And the boundaries are what keeps you safe together in the relationship and helps trust to really develop deeply. Giving somebody choice is incredibly important. That's what part of that. They're all linked. All of these things are linked. So somebody will trust you as you start to let them take the lead in things and have the choice about things. You're not doing things unto them. So many of the people we work with constantly have things done unto them, with no choice, no even stopping and asking, do you want this shirt today or this shirt? Sometimes it's just tiny things, really. And then other things like collaboration, that's where we are kind of leading into that really choice, but collaboration. So we talk a lot about co-production today in our society. But what I see often as co-production is so minimal and tick boxy. And true co-production means also sharing the power in the relationship and enabling somebody to really be able to say something about what they think should be happening. And you might not agree with it, but actually they're living the life. So really being able to give up your power and your sense of being the authority, which then leads to empowerment. So then you're empowering somebody. But also thinking about all of that within the cultural world of that person, not denying that, not recognizing that sometimes actually cultural norms for that person are incredibly important, and not expecting somebody to live in the cultural norms of the setting within which they find themselves. But and recognizing also that through their own family culture, their own community culture, there may be generational trauma that also comes with that, and recognizing and thinking about that as well. So there's a lot to trauma. You know, there's waves and waves that need to be thought about, but they're also really connected in how we can support someone and empower someone and enable someone.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And so those six principles are often what is referred to as like having a trauma sensitive environment or trauma informed practice, right? And I think it's helpful to just like go through them as you've done, because a lot of people think, well, if we have a so we have a traumatized young person in our care who has severe learning disabilities, then what they need is specialist therapy like that. And that may be true.
Okay. Up to that person. You don't have to think about it anymore.
Yes, exactly. But what you've just described is not is is achievable within the context of an ordinary care setting. So like, what would it mean for a team? Say there's a let's think about social care, because that's where we are a lot. So maybe a house for four young people with severe learning disabilities. You know, maybe there's some signs of presentations of trauma in those young people. Like, what would it mean to like, and what would be the impact of an organization beginning to embed those principles in their care?
That's a great question. But also, all of those principles also apply to the staff who are working there. Because if you've got disempowered, and also, I mean, within the staff group, you may also have people with their own trauma. It would not be unexpected. So the trauma, being trauma informed in an organisation means really thinking about everybody in the organisation and empowering everybody, and thinking relationally about everybody. And it has to start from the top. The people who are the most powerful people in the organization have to be prepared to share their power. And that's often the hardest place to start, if I'm really honest. If I go into places and they say, oh, come and work with us. We really want to learn how to be trauma informed. And I, you know, when I was younger and less, a bit more naive, I would say, yes, of course, I'll come in. And they'd only really let me work with the care workers. And so we do, you know, great work. And the care workers would be really empowered and excited, and great things would happen. And then I kind of have some follow-up sessions with them. And they were so down because they hadn't really been able to implement anything, because nothing had changed in the whole organization. Light bulb moment, should have thought about that long before I ever started. But now I always know you need to start at the top. You have to have absolute real heartfelt buy-in for this from the top, or it won't work. And it's really hard for people who are responsible for organizations to give up or share the power, because ultimately the buck still stops with them. So good decisions have to be made, but they have to trust that actually they have to really be on board that this is the way forward to enable a much better life for the people living there, and actually a more harmonious and probably more committed staff team. So all those principles that I talked about, safety, trust, collaboration, empowerment, cultural awareness, choice, needs to be there for the staff as well as for people living there. And that then enables the staff to be able to work in the kind of way that I was talking about, and to know that they have the support of the senior leaders to do that, because a lot of support is needed to work in this way, because the raw material is you yourself, and so you're more likely to be all those things that unconsciously we talked about people defending themselves against, being really emotionally in touch with the pain of the people they're supporting. If you're re working relationally, you're in touch with that, and it's painful and difficult. And the person might hurt you. You know, they may still hurt you, even though you're trying to be a good person for them. Things will trigger them, and things will get out of control. And sometimes you may get hurt, and that how, you know, how do you then repair that? You need good support around you to be able to feel confident enough and safe enough to know that that can be repaired. And the repair of relational tears are a really important part of trauma-informed practice as well, because for many people, they keep people at bay because they're dangerous. And experiencing the fact that actually someone comes back in a non-dangerous way, if something's gone wrong and they've been hurt, is a really important move forwards. But none of that can happen without really good organisation support. Reflective practice would be a really important part of that as well. Reflecting on what's happened and being able to move forwards and understand some of the unconscious.
Yeah, and you know what, that feels like that's you can I feel the difficulty of bringing that all the way up to the top, not just asking it of the those principals of the care staff. Like it feels like easy to ask of a care staff member, you need to be collaborative with the young person you're working with. You need to work together on things. You need to listen to them and give them choice and empower them and respect them. And then if that staff member doesn't do that, for a manager to say to them, you have to do it. I've told you to do it. We've like this is the way that you do it. I don't know why you're not doing it. If you don't work like that, then we're going to discipline you. And that approach to the staff member is not about empowerment or collaboration or trust or safety or like you've and
I'm
yes, you're frightening them into trying to bring about a safe response. And that's where it's that I think for an organization to actually go after this, they have to start unraveling all of their power dynamics. And that feels scary for
That's
them.
hugely, hugely challenging. And the bigger the organization, the bigger that challenge. So if we think about our statutory services, they're built on hierarchy and power. You know, Scotland are having a really good go at that. They've really been working brilliantly at this. I think it's not easy, and I think they've still a long way to go. But I think they really took a good long look at the fact that they were struggling with obesity, with drug addiction, with alcohol addiction, with so many really difficult things that were happening for the people in their communities. And that there were so many programs that were just addressing this behavior. And then light bulb moments, I don't know exactly how it came about, but like, you know, gradually they've started as a country to look at what's underneath that is trauma. And so, as such, so fantastic. There are other countries around the world. I know you've done some good traveling to America where they've got good stuff as well. But it's a big shift, and it's not something you can do with a tick box. You know, this is not the new model where you can just go, aha, here's the plan. We've ticked this off. It just doesn't work like that. It's a major cultural shift, and power sharing is probably the most challenging part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's not, and I think also to bring in like trauma-informed practice or trauma-informed care, it's not a project that you get to the end of. It's a commitment to a way of operating. And I think, yeah, and I think I'm one of my the most one of fascinating example when I was in the US, I went to see an organization who'd spent years and like quite honestly hundreds of thousands of dollars bringing in trauma-informed care across every aspect of their huge organization. You know, everybody had been brought into this way of thinking, and I asked them, how's that actually playing out in the interactions between your direct support staff and the young people that you care for? And they said, well, go and see, go and talk to them. So I was able to go and look around one of the houses, and it was great. They were doing a great job. And I asked, like, how does this inform your practice with the young people? And they gave me all the right answers, you know, like, well, we understand that young people are responding to their traumatic histories, and we're chatting. And then they drop in. I asked, well, what are the ratios? And they say, oh, well, probably two staff in here. And yes, unless we're using a prone restraint, and then we would have three staff. So a prone restraint is where you hold someone flat on the floor. It's known to be traumatic, and it's also known to be at risk of death. People have died through that restraint. And it just blew my mind, well, that they had put all this work and all this effort into trying to unravel all the power. And right at the end of the line, there were still children being held flat on the floor in a trauma-informed organization.
That's tragic. And they'll go themselves as being a trauma-informed organisation.
And that there was still this defense that at the end of the day, we will use power to address a traumatic response. It's really, really hard to unravel this stuff, isn't it? That's what I came away like. These guys, they're really working hard, and they're doing the best they can, but they can't, like, when rubber hits the road, they're still reverting to a power response.
Yeah, which makes me feel they haven't totally really understood what they needed to do in the first place. They thought if they spent a lot of money,
Lots.
it could change without it being difficult. The thing is that it's a difficult thing to change. You know, we're asking for a fundamentally difficult thing to change. Not you know, not we started off the conversation by saying actually the way that we are with people. That isn't difficult, and all those six principles fit together really, you know, they just flow. They're hardly separate from one another, but it's important to make the distinctions. But the bigger the organization is and the more hierarchical it is, and the more fear actually there will be in an organization that has that hierarchy as well, because the pe people at the very bottom of it are really distanced from people at the very top, and there's much more fear happens when there is that distance.
And
So,
that fear piece, I feel, is like so key to understanding what's happening in these organizations. Because if we understand that trauma is essentially an overwhelming experience of fear, like, one of the things that we look out for when we go, you know, maybe we're just going to meet one young person who's really self-injuring and trying to understand what's happening for them, or maybe we're working a bit more systemically with an organization. But I'm often looking out for, where's the fear? Like, where is it in the room? Where is it for the child? Where is it for the staff team? And you like these, like, increasingly, I can identify when we have a young person who is really traumatized. It happened the other day. I walked into a space, it's a classroom. There was a young man I've been asked to go and see, and fear was overwhelming the environment. I was literally frightened as soon as I walked in the door. And the young man is just relaxing. He's just relaxing the other side of the classroom. And it felt like fear was rolling off him because of the levels of trauma that he was holding in his body, and then was rippling out into the room, into the staff, into the young people, and it was uncontained. And for me, that's not behavior. That is straight up overwhelming fear. And that's when we have to start thinking from a trauma perspective and thinking about, how do we hold and heal that amount of terror that's existing in a child? There's no, and all of these principles you've been talking about are ways of re-establishing a sense of safety for the staff team, and then for the child, because nobody felt safe in that room.
and it's not easy to do that either, because, you know, as you described so beautifully, your interaction with a woman in the wheelchair, when you make yourself really open and available to somebody who is as terrorized as that child you just described it, you open yourself to their terror to come into your world in the here and now. And that's not easy. Now, there are so many incredible care staff who are brave and wonderful in their ways of relating with young people or adults, actually, but they're marvelous. I can't praise them more. But if they don't have the support and the safety around them, it's not fair to ask them to work in this way. It really isn't, because who is there for them? And then they'll burn out, they'll leave, they'll be hurt, all sorts of awful things will happen. So you can kind of see how, if that's not happening higher up in the organization, the defenses will be even stronger further down the organization. If people don't feel like someone's got my back, they'll be there for me. How do you provide that sense of safety for all in order for this trauma to be healed? It's big work, and it's not tick box work. And I don't want to put people off by saying that either, but I really want people to do it authentically, because it's not going to work as a tick box exercise.
No, and I know that's absolutely right. But it is, I often think it is the work that most of us came in to do, whether we could articulate it or not, that most of us ended up in these kinds of environments because there was something inside us that essentially wants to live relationally, wants to live out of connection, and wants to, we want to. That's part of the job, isn't it? Like they have that sort of sense of like there's something in me that I need to unravel and sort out. That's what brings us into the work. But then understanding that we can actually offer something to somebody that's really useful and that will help them live a better life. But we have to do it together.
I'm wanting to see people not living in pain and terror. It is a terrible thing to see. Again, going back to the long stay hospitals that were my early training ground, I found them, the first time I ever went into one of those hospitals, was terrifying, because people were just wandering about with their pain, rocking and, dressed in filthy, ragged clothes, nobody interacting with them at all. They were crazy places, and people had lived there for 30 or 40 years. And rather than, I was fearful. I wasn't fearful of those people, I don't think. I don't think it was that. I was fearful of that this could be a place where people were just alone but together, and pain was resounding. And I think that actually has always drawn me to want to do something about it. Things aren't Well, I say things aren't as bad as that now. Well, they are. I still go to psychiatric hospitals. They're more modern, they're more clean. Actually, they're terrifying in that way. And we still got sort of 2,000 people with learning disabilities or autism locked up, in very different ways, actually, often on their own, which is also, they're literally on their own. So these people were on their own together. Now we put people in what Alexis Quinn so eloquently calls solitary confinement, because that's absolutely what it is. And that in its own way is punishing and terrible.
It's funny, isn't it? We've like the sort of story of the long stay institutions that people with learning disabilities w were in sort of 50 years ago, and that deinstitutionalization process. I was writing about that in my Churchill report recently, and talking about the shadow that it still casts a shadow. Like it's we have closed the institutions, but the core reasons why we had them in the first place hasn't really been resolved, and so we keep playing it out, and just calling it different things.
We're still part of their history as well. That generation are still living amongst us, and the pain of that is still amongst us. Playing it out, it had nothing. Nothing has really changed. There's not what we need within our society and within what we've created as support for people to live in our society. It's not. We haven't got it right.
No, we haven't. There is so much to do. But I guess like one of the things that I always try and hold on to when we're thinking about trauma and how it impacts people and teams and organizations is that it is recoverable, right? It's we can recover, we can heal.
Exactly. So So we have to do that difficult thing, don't we? It may not be easy, but it absolutely it's recoverable. And we have to do that thing.
And because the sense of that default place of living from fear, which trauma creates, that's an adaptive response. And so, like, the brain can adapt the other way as well, but needs the repeat experiences for the brain and the body to remember again that it can be seen.
So that the traumatic responses are unconscious, so they're really powerful and really strong and really easily triggered. And to start to change those, you have to do very conscious things that are not that easy. And that's the difficult thing, isn't it? But keeping conscious and really putting what's needed consciously around making that change. But we have become more conscious of it since you and I were talking a little bit about why now, because I've been banging on about trauma for decades, and nobody really wanted to hear that. It's like, oh, there's Noelle again going on about trauma. She's a therapist kind of thing. But now, suddenly, everybody wants to know about trauma-informed care, and I'm kind of thrilled about that. But I'm also a little bit cross with people because it's like, well, why haven't you been listening earlier? But it's interesting that it's now, and I think we should think a little bit about that because I think we've all been through a lot in the last few years, haven't we? That I think must have made this something that people are kind of going, ah, I get it now. I get it. Trauma is, we've all been through the pandemic together, and that was terrifying. We all lived in sort of terror of our lives of this invisible thing that we couldn't see that could kill us and was killing people around us in huge numbers.
Yeah, and it was like a collective experience of first feeling like we lost control, and then I think for some of us realizing that maybe we were never that in control in the first place. Which is like a ne next layer. And then yeah, I think that we saw people respond differently, didn't we? For some people, we probably all have, somebody in our lives who doesn't really feel like they recovered from the pandemic. They're still frightened. They're still frightened of like what they can catch or what might come into their home, or it's really got inside them. Rather than something that they sort of moved out of the pandemic as we collectively moved out of those restrictions, the restrictions remained in them because they have internalized what happened, and it's shaken their sense of safety. And I think it's been helpful for us to see how a so-called shared, what looks on the surface to be a shared event, leads to wildly different responses from one person to the next.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's an important thing to notice. No two people will respond the same way to a trauma. So many, we won't go there because that's a whole other conversation, but there's so many reasons why people will respond in different ways. But I think, we've had we've got so much going on. We've had austerity and lack of services and, real kind of like, an impoverished feel around us as a society in the UK for a very long time as well, and I think that has its tra collective trauma. We have a real dividing thing going on, extremes in politics and dividing us. That's very traumatic. And then outside of our country, we have some terrible wars that are looking, to be quite terrifying. And well, they affect us, economically, but they also, there's a real fear that more and more countries will start joining in these wars and we'll have a third world war. So, the trauma is very real for all of us in these last few years. And I think it's woken people up to that. I think maybe we were quietly complacent after the Second World War that, we were safe again,
That's right. That's right. And then the layer of like the racial justice conversations following the murder of George Floyd, right? Where, for we've probably all been on our own individual journeys, but for some people, realizing that we're living in a racist world and racist structures, for some people, like waking up to the first time and then having to recalibrate, like look back on their history and be like, have I always been in this world? And then for others, for many of my friends, being like, well, I've always known we've lived in this world, But finally, there's a space to talk about it. And that very, very different experiences, but that's still that's shaken a lot of people and a lot of people's like sense of what their own histories are and what our country's history is. Yeah, so.
Interesting to have the context. Always important to have the context, I
Yeah,
think.
the wide contexts. So, like, yeah, so I think it's on everybody's minds, isn't it? And it's on in everybody's unconscious to some extent, in a way that it maybe we were maybe it was, but we weren't so aware of it. We weren't able to talk about it so much. So maybe I can ask you, like what would it look like, or have you got an example of an organization or a small group of people who have worked with someone with learning disabilities who's traumatized and have tried to do some of this work? Like what's been the impact? What does it look and feel like? Like what sort of process is it? Because I feel like we've really grappled with the difficulty of this, but we do believe the reason that we're here is we believe it's doable. So what does it look like when it's done well or well enough?
That's such a good question, and I've got so many people whizzing through my head that I've been in their lives to try to support them. So at Respond, we had a really amazing project at one time where we were invited or commissioned, but it felt like an invite to work with a particular commissioning authority to support them to really get to the point where they had no people with learning disabilities or autism from their area in hospitals out of area or in hospitals full stop. And they liked the way that we worked with our talk. So we had a trauma-informed model that brought together elements of what Respond did in any case. So training, reflective practice, psychotherapy, and also something which we did with people who had a forensic history, which are called circles of support and accountability, or COSAs. And I worked with Circles UK, who are the umbrella organisation of that, to say, look, I think that this model of a COSA, which brings together a small group of volunteers around an individual who's at risk, and really gives them unwavering support and trust, all those things that are about being trauma informed, actually, that they will stick with them, whatever, even if they mess up and do something terrible again, they're still there the next week when they meet with them, and they'll be able to talk about the difficult stuff, and they'll be able to think with the person, almost be like an augmented augment their own brain to think through what happened there and why. And how maybe could we help it to be different next time? And we thought that that would be really helpful around people who ended up in hospital because their behaviour was challenging. So we brought together all these components into a model that actually supported people in a trauma-informed way while they were in hospital to get ready to move out of hospital and then to move out of hospital and remain out of hospital because we supported the staff as well. So it was quite a kind of a long journey. It started with training, reflective practice in the hospital, started with sometimes some psychotherapy in the hospital. Gradually, there'd be a team of our staff in the hospital that would be the beginnings of the COSA around the person, and then they would be joined by volunteers was the plan as they came out, and they became kind of safer and less frightening to work with in the community. And we had some incredible successes with that, where people remained out of hospital for several, for like as long as we worked with them, really, and all of those components were part of it. But it was a very intense model. It was quite a complicated model. But I also can think of, and that, but there's also actually there's a wonderful thing called the HOPES model at the moment, which is a not dissimilar model. But I also think of some of the families who have just fought through that because of their love, fought so hard for people to come out of hospital. And brought people in through their kind of passion. And there's one young man, I probably shouldn't mention his name here because he will be well known, but his mother lost him at the age of 14 to institutions, and he was in those institutions for, nearly 30 years. And eventually she managed to get him home, and she fought to say, no, not out of hospital over there, all those hundreds of miles away from me, which is what began. But here, where he belongs, where his community are, where his siblings are, and eventually now he lives right near her. He's part of his family's life. He is a big, gentle giant, and his life is he's so happy. And I knew him for a good decade of those years where he was so unhappy. And that, for me, that is wonderful.
Yeah.
And that was the love really. But, his mum was so powerful. She just would not let anyone keep hold of him any longer.
Wow.
Jolly
Yeah.
enough.
Yeah, that feels like a good note to finish on, particularly thinking about that. Like, I know that Alexis Quinn talks a lot about like professional love and bringing love back into the care sector. And I one of the things I noticed in the US is there's not really any space to talk about love that in the social care sector that I saw. But in the UK, increasingly we were understanding like, that old saying like perfect love casts out fear, and I would add safety to that. But that there is that we need to rediscover how we provide loving homes and loving spaces for
Everybody safe.
exactly.
Two things. Yeah. Warm boundaries.
Yeah, warm boundaries. Great.
Really lovely to talk to you, Beth. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Yeah, absolute pleasure to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for listening today. Before you go, can you help us with something? We want to make sure these conversations reach the people who need to hear them. So if there's someone you think would benefit from listening to this, we would just love it if you shared it. See you next time.